I'm Sue and I'm an alcoholic. And believe me, this is me. I'm known as Sobbing Sorry Sue. And I'll explain this. I always start this way, not because I want to, it just seems to happen. I get up and I look out and I see sober people and I truly realize that if it were not for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for people like you, that I would not be alive today. I believe that. My sobriety date is November 29th, 1978, so in just a little over a month, I have every reason to believe that I will be celebrating my 20th anniversary. I am no longer, not here yet, but I believe that if I continue to do everything that I've done for the past almost 20 years, that I will be sober as long as I don't pick up that first drink, and that's what I was taught by sponsors and the people that were in the room ahead of me, and by people, the power example of people that came after me. I see. I didn't get nervous and knew that I wouldn't because it's typical for me about speaking. And at first I want to thank everybody that was involved in asking me to speak and making the arrangements so that I'm here. But I didn't get nervous until I walked up those steps to go over there and sit down. And I looked out and saw all of the familiar faces. One of the hardest groups to speak to is right in your own hometown or where you got sober, where everybody knows you. And I think that half the people here are from the area that I got sober in. So I'm really going to have to watch my P's and Q's today. On November 29th, 1978, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got up that morning, I had absolutely no idea that that evening at 8:30 I was going to walk into a room of sober people. It was not my intention. 2 weeks prior to that day, I had called a mental health clinic in Salisbury, Maryland, and told them that I was depressed and I was needed a little help and that I didn't have any money and I needed to come to a clinic to see someone. And they said to me that they could make an appointment and did I need to see somebody right away. And I said, oh no, I'm just fine. And they made the appointment for 2 weeks from that day, and I was suicidal. I was obsessed with the thought of killing myself. I didn't want to live. I was drinking every day, and my answer was, I'm okay, I can wait 2 weeks, it's typical. I made it that 2 weeks. I went to the mental health clinic, and to this day, I don't know what the man saw, but he asked me if I would see a psychiatrist, and that suited me just fine, because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Someone had told me that I might be, and of course I said, no, absolutely not, not me. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I really wanted to be crazy. That was socially acceptable. That would explain what was wrong with me. They could give me a pill, and I knew what I wanted, and I'd be okay. You know, everything was going to be fine. Just do what I want you to do to treat me, and everything's going to be fine. I spent lots and lots of times telling people, I don't need any help, I can do this all by myself. I was usually drunk when I said that. And I figured that when I really did need a little help, it could be in the form of a pill. And I hadn't taken any pills prior to this, but something had to get me out of this depression. I agreed to see a psychiatrist, and I was sent back to my apartment and told that he would call me. I was told that he would call me on the telephone, and I said, okay, I'll be there. And for some reason, I didn't pick up a drink. I don't know exactly when I stopped drinking the night before. I don't know if it was before midnight. I don't know if it was after midnight. I know that my last drunk was what had been typical for me for a long period of time. I got home from work. The first thing I did was pick up a bottle on the way home from work of wine by this time. I went in my apartment, I poured a drink, and I continued to drink until I passed out. And I don't know when that last drink was. I went home from the mental health clinic, and I didn't drink for some reason. He didn't tell me not to. I just simply didn't drink. And sometime that afternoon, a man named Charlie called me And Charlie asked me if I would come to his office that night. Now, I hadn't said anything to this man at the mental health clinic about my drinking. He asked me if I did, and I said yes, but he would too if he'd had the husband I'd had and the problems I had, and he was separated. You know, it just, there were reasons for my drinking. Whatever he saw, when this guy named Charlie called me, he asked me if I'd meet him at his office, and I said I would. And he said, well, it's just going to be the two of us. And I knew that that really wasn't ethical, because you're supposed to have another person in the office. He said, but would that be okay with you? And I thought about it, and I said, okay, that'll be fine. And I went to his office, 7:30, I don't even know what time it was now, and went in, and he did all the wrong things. I knew exactly what Charlie was supposed to do. He was supposed to sit there quietly and give me a chance to give him my story about how depressed I was and how sad I was and how terrible my life had been and that my mother didn't love me and just on and on and on. And then he was going to give me some pills and then I was going to go home. Well, what actually happened was this man started talking to me, and for the first time in my life, in my adult life, he made sense to me, and I knew that he was talking about himself and that he understood me completely. And he did the most glorious 12-step call on me you've ever seen. Charlie was a sober psychiatrist in this program. For some reason, he knew that I was a drunk, and it was a series of circumstances that he knew about me before I even got there. And he told his story. And I knew that this man was talking to me, and he understood, and he didn't look down on me. And then he said to me, will you go to an AA meeting? Well, I had no other place to go. I was ready. He had me. It was a setup, plain and simple. And I said, okay, I'll go. And he walked me out the door of his office, across the street, down the block, and into an 8:30 meeting on a Wednesday night. And I was hooked, plain and simple. It was cold. It was rainy. I was crying. I thought that my life was over. I was 36 years old. I walked in the room and thought that all you people were well. I learned better later. But I was... That first night, you all were well. And, you know, I knew in here that I was going to be okay. Nobody looked at me like I was what I thought I was. I was a female alcoholic, and I absolutely, totally hated myself. I had been taught that there was something morally wrong with female alcoholics. Alcoholics in general, you know, there's something wrong with those people. But to be female and alcoholic was doubly bad. And I couldn't look at my face in a mirror. I grew up in a small town, and my aunt had disappeared at age 36. And when she was 36, she had already experienced DTs. So I was a young child. I remember looking up in my aunt's house, looking up at the top of the steps. I was at the foot and looking up, and my grandfather was blocking her from coming down the steps, and she kicked him down the stairs. And, you know, that's a memory for a kid. I didn't learn until I was sober that she was suffering DTs at the time. She disappeared just about that time, never to be heard from again. So I grew up hearing that my Aunt Elsie was a bad person. She was an immoral woman. She ran off with a man and she drank. And she had everything and still did these things, therefore she was bad. So when I no longer could control my drinking and things were happening in my life, I really hated myself. And these people in the room made me feel okay. That's not to say I walked out of that room and everything was fine, because I certainly didn't. I don't remember what was said that night. I don't remember what the subject was. I don't know who led the meeting. I know there were a lot of people. I know that a guy named Randy came over and talked to me, and many other people said that they did. And Randy and Charlie sat down and told me about what alcohol did to people like me and how it caused depression, and drew a little scale, and I understood exactly what they were saying. And Charlie really hooked me. I like bargains. I hear there's an outlet mall close by, but I really love bargains. And Charlie said to me, if you will remain alcohol-free for 3 months and you still think you're crazy, I will treat you free of charge. And I really couldn't pass him up on that deal. And somehow I knew what these people were telling me was also true, that I was in the right place even though I didn't want to be. I went home that night, and Charlie told me where a meeting was the next night and to meet him there. It didn't take right away. I felt tremendous that night. I got up the next morning and Charlie called me to see if I was okay. But man, I was looking for an easier, softer way. I went to work. I was still working. And I got up and I went to work and I was terrified. And I thought everybody in the town of Salisbury had seen me go in this meeting the night before. I was so paranoid, and that I had alcoholic woman slut written on the top of my forehead, and they could all see it, you know. But and I got to work, and I happened to be working with a man that day, and I hadn't worked with him for 2, 3, 4 weeks. And I knew that he had stopped drinking. I knew that he had gone someplace around the D.C. area, and he came back to work, and he no longer smelled like gin, and he wasn't sarcastic, and he was being nice to everybody, and that he didn't drink anymore. So I went to this man, and his name was Ken, and I said, Ken, I know that you had a drinking problem. And I went to a meeting last night of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the hardest thing I've had to say to somebody until that time, you know, to say to this man that I've worked with for years. And I said, I know that you stopped drinking, and what did you do? And he looked at me and he said, welcome to the club. And I said a few four-letter words, I think, at the time. But kind of knew that if it worked for him, it was okay for me. And I went to a meeting that night. I had no intentions when I started drinking of being an alcoholic like everybody else. I don't know if anybody that willingly picks up a drink and says, you know, this is going to lead me to a life of hell, and I just think I'll do it because it might be fun. I started drinking. I don't remember my first drink. I started drinking when I was probably around 15. I know that I was drinking before I was driving, and I know that I was going out on dates and drinking, and boys were buying booze. I grew up in the Berlin Ocean City area and had many, many friends whose parents had hotels and motels in Ocean City. And in the wintertime, they would go to Florida, and the kids for several weeks, and the kids would stay with friends and go to school. And we were allowed to open up motels and hotels and apartments and party, and it just happened to be what I thought was a normal life. There's some people here probably that did that in Ocean City in the wintertime. And, of course, in the summertime, everybody partied. I didn't know until I went away from school went away to school, that most people didn't grow up the way I grew up. I had isolated myself from the friends in high school that didn't party the way I did, and I was with a group that partied every weekend. I was away from home and in school after high school, and my roommate, I was probably 17 years old, and I'd been out and I'd been drinking, and I came in after hours when I wasn't supposed to, and I didn't get caught except by my roommate. And I was sitting down on the floor like this, and I was hysterical, laughing, drunk out of my mind. And she came out and she looked at me and she said, "You know, you're nothing but a damn alcoholic." And I thought the only problem that existed in that room was Marion, and her problem was the fact that she was from Boston, Massachusetts, and was just simply didn't know how to have fun. And I honestly believe that. I married. I continued to party. By the time I was 20, I started drinking liquor. I hated beer. I had gone from gin to vodka. I was drinking bourbon when I was 20. I got married just before I was 21. I had a child when I was 23. And the only difference between my first episode of drinking and my last was the time periods between drinks over a period of about 20 years got shorter and shorter. As a teenager, I drank on weekends and when I partied. As a young married woman, I was out of school and out of my parents' house and in my own home so I could have some drinks before dinner. I was the person that when we went out on weekends, when I started getting dressed to go out, I started to had to have a little drink to kind of help get dressed and start the partying early. By the time I finished my drinking, I was drinking daily. And, you know, when I first came to this program, I said that I didn't drink on the job. And I honestly believe that I didn't drink on the job. And I was about, except for a few times when I was on call. I went to a girlfriend's house one night. I was on call and I had to stay in Salisbury. And there was a wine bottle in her refrigerator. And I just wanted, you know how you're just going to have one. And I just wanted to have a taste of this wine because I'd never tried that particular brand before. And that's a good reason. And I pulled the jug out, the carafe out. It was way in the back of the refrigerator. And you have to be real careful when you do something like that you get every little item back in just exactly the right spot so they won't notice you've been in there. And I had my first little glass of wine, and it really was very good. And I had my second, and I drank almost the whole thing, and it was white wine, so I was able to fill it up with water. And she wasn't an alcoholic, probably never knew that I'd been in there. But I was an operating room nurse, and I was on call, and it's not real cool to have wine or booze on your breath when you go in on call. They disapprove of that. I never got called down for that, and that happened on a few different occasions. When I said I didn't drink while I was at work, when I was sober about 2 years, I got this little cough. It had a very stressful situation, and I got this little tickle. And when I got this little tickle in my throat, I ran out to the medicine cabinet, and we kept a fishing tackle box full of drugs just for the nurses to take when they were not feeling well, Tylenol and cough syrup and all sorts of wonderful things. And I grabbed the bottle of cough syrup, and I was going to do my usual tilt back when nobody was looking and drink a little bit, and I remembered what I'd been taught when I was newly sober. Now, I hadn't had any cough syrup up until this moment, and it was kind of a stress thing. It was an automatic reaction for me to do that. And I was like this, and I looked at the bottle. Something said Sue, and I looked at the bottle, and it was 12.5% alcohol. And I realized and was horrified for the first time to realize that I had been drinking on the job without even knowing what I was doing. Because I coughed every day a lot. And I would run for that tackle box and I would grab that bottle of Benadryl and I'd get my fix to keep my alcohol level where it was supposed to be and then I'd go back to work. I mean, it was just real simple to do. Without even thinking, I did these things. When I was sober, about the same amount of time, I thought that I had learned about all there was to learn and went through some difficult times and realized that my sponsors had been right and my the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous had been right, and that what worked in this program was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And once again, I had been looking for that easier, softer way. And I remember having a yard sale and putting all of my self-help books in the yard sale and going back to the very basics being the steps of this program. When in 1977 I left, I had one child, this marriage, when I got married when I was 21, and about 21, and I had the one child, and I did things that normal mothers do not do. When my son was little, I was able to go to Little League games, and I was able to sit on the benches and root with other mothers. By the time he finished his Little League experience, I was sitting in the car, and I was drinking my beer in the car. I was drinking beer by then, and I couldn't get out and socialize with the other mothers because I was drinking too much. I also rationalized that I really was on a higher plane than they were anyway. They got too involved with their children and these games. And I was there, and I was more sportsmanlike, and I really got on this superior thing that all children were equal, and I didn't want to embarrass my son and by rooting for both teams because the other mothers frowned on that. Therefore, I'd stay out of their way. You know, I rationalized everything I did so that by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, my drinking was everybody else's fault. I truly could not look at myself. And there's a guy, I thought about this recently because I saw him recently, and he mentioned it recently. So he thought of it originally. I have to give him credit. A guy named Quincy. And Jim took Quincy and I to Laurel to speak, and there was Jim in the car, Quincy, and me, and we went to Laurel, Delaware, and there were six people in the room, Jim, Quincy, me, and three men that sat right there and stared at us. And on the way home, Quincy said that when he came in, he really didn't know a lot of his story, and the longer he stayed sober, the more he remembered. And I remember saying to him, you know, Quincy, if I had known when I came in everything that I know now about myself, I don't think that I could have stayed sober. I think that the self-loathing would have been so tremendous that I really could not have stayed sober. I think God revealed to me, when I was able to handle it, what I did. I did neglect my son. I did do things drinking that I would not do as a sober woman. And I can tell you that I tried some of them as a sober woman. When I came here, people told me, you know, people said, this is what we do, and these are the steps we took, and I thought everybody was really great in following the steps. And I remember saying to Charlie, I don't want to be nice. I thought you all were just so nice and so sweet and so kind, and I had never been nice, sweet, and kind, and was afraid that I couldn't be. One of the women at work, one of the secretaries at work, after about 2 or 3 months after she'd been hired, walked up to me and said, you're not anything like they said you were. I think you're really nice. And what she had seen, it went through my mind, she saw me as a sober person, and what all these other people had seen me as was a drinking person. And when I was drinking, my moods were so erratic. You know, I was either drunk or needing a drink, and I don't know which was worse. I think needing a drink was worse than being drunk because I was horrible. I was not kind, to put it gently, not kind to my coworkers. I remember making grown big women cry with my mouth and with my tongue. And I felt that I was justified in doing that because they were stupid. And I honestly believed that I was superior, and I had to do that. You know, I had to build myself up in certain areas so that I could function. And Charlie was, and that was one of them. He kept saying, Sue, you're an alcoholic. You did this, you did this, you did this, you did this. And I said, Charlie, you're right, but I'm good at my job. I'm really good at my job. And I was being promoted. People didn't like me very much, but I was being promoted all the time, and I was being given more responsibility all the time, and I was going home every night and drinking till I passed out and getting up the next morning and turning circles and going into work and doing a good job and then going home and picking up that wine on the way home and drinking until I passed out again. And that was the only thing that I had left, the only thing. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was different because my family hadn't left me. I walked away from a marriage of 14 years and that son to be liberated. It was the 70s, ladies, and they'd burnt bras and they'd done all sorts of wonderful things, and I was going to be part of it. And I got an apartment. I laugh when I hear people talk about geographical changes, because I moved 25 miles from my home into an apartment and I was liberated. And there were no controls on my drinking. And that last year of drinking was pure hell. When I got sober and they talked about staying away from slippery places, I could not take a bath for a year. I wasn't dirty for a year. I was able to take showers, but my routine was I would drink my drinks and I'd fill my bathtub with bubble bath and I'd put my ashtray and my cigarette and my bottle by the bathtub and I'd get in the tub and I'm lucky that I didn't pass out and drown. Sometimes when I got out of the tub, it was hours later and it was cold and I couldn't remember when I got in. I was one of the drunks that would call a friend of mine, and Al knows her. We had dinner with her one day this week. And I would call Becky on the phone, drunk, and I would say, Becky, I'm going to kill myself. And she would say, no, you're not, and she was so easy. And I could keep her on the phone for a long time, threatening to kill myself. And she wouldn't hang up. She would say things like, I'm going to send the police. And I would say, if you send the police to my apartment, I'll have you arrested for a break. You know, I played all the games. And the thing is, I didn't remember any of this. Becky's told me all of this since I've been sober. I'm fortunate that I didn't die on the highway. I could drive from Ocean City to Salisbury in a blackout and go in my apartment and wake up the next morning and the door would be open and I don't know if somebody was there or not there. And to this day, don't know, but know that the door was open. My husband will tell you today, I don't lock doors, so who knows? I don't, and maybe I don't want to know. I smoked, and there would be holes in the sheets and on the mattresses. I'm fortunate to be alive. We went to a convention in Norfolk many years ago, and a man came over from Ireland. I was so impressed with this man. He came from Ireland to make amends to a woman in Norfolk, Virginia, that he had left at the altar about 15 years prior to that, to go all the way from Ireland. And, you know, man, this is really something. And I realized that I couldn't go from Salisbury to Berlin, Maryland, to make amends to my grandmother, who was in her 90s. And what a small person I was to not be able to do that. I learned about myself by listening to and watching people in this program, by the power of example. But this guy from Ireland that went all that way to make amends to this woman said to let those things that hadn't happened to me yet, when I kept saying it hasn't happened to me yet, that hasn't happened to me yet, let that yet stand for you're eligible too. And when I think about it, I am eligible too. I said that I didn't have a temper. I didn't have a temper most of the time when I was drinking. When I drank, I didn't know what I was going to be. I could cry, I could laugh, I could be a screaming maniac, I could be anything. When I was sober, And with sobriety came a temper that I had to learn to deal with soberly, and I didn't like it. I became so angry in sobriety for the first time in my life that I realized that I was capable of killing another human being. And this was sobriety, this wasn't drinking, and I was devastated that sweet little old Sue was angry enough to kill, and I was angry. Early in sobriety, I thought, yeah, I'll work these steps, and I'm not as really as sick as these people, and by the time I've been going to meetings for a year, I'm not going to need it anymore because I'm not that sick, and I really believed it. I know that the steps of this program have kept me sober, and working the steps or living the steps or whatever terminology you're comfortable with using, putting the steps in my life has kept me sober. But going to meetings and being around other members of Alcoholics Anonymous and being reminded of what I am and who I am by being around people like me has been so great a part, has meant so much in my sobriety. When I was sober about 5 years, I want to tell you about working steps before I tell you about what happened when I was sober 5 years, but I did not say, oh gee, I'm going to get up this morning and I think I'll do 2, 3, 4, 5, and then next week maybe I'll do such and such. I got sober at 3 months. I felt so good. I mean, I felt wonderful. I thought I'd done enough for a while. You know, I was going to rest on my laurels. I was on that pink cloud. By the time I was a year sober, so that I wouldn't drink, I found it necessary to work the fourth and the fifth step. I never sat down and said, I think I'll do this. It was pain that caused me to work the steps so that I wouldn't drink. I wanted to be sober more than I wanted to drink, and I've been that way since I came to this program. Therefore, every time the pain got so bad that I thought I might pick up a drink, I picked up a step instead, and that worked for me and continues to work for me. When I was sober about 5 years, my husband and I moved to Florida, and that was real difficult. I'd established a niche in Salisbury. The people that I got sober with were there. I knew new people that came in. I was sponsoring people. I was doing all the things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of a sudden, we pack up and we move to Florida. And it was different. And after I'd been there for a while, I realized that it wasn't different. Alcoholics Anonymous was the same. The customs were different, and I don't change willingly. I really don't. And I had to look at it. I mean, it really doesn't matter if they open with the Lord's Prayer and close with the Serenity Prayer, or what they call the person that's up at the front of the room, or exactly how they lead the meeting or chair the meeting. All of the customs are immaterial. But I had real difficulty with that, and there was a lot of personal growth for me there. It was preparing me for the personal growth that I would experience when I moved to Mississippi 3 years later. And there were... In the town that I lived in Mississippi, it was a town about the size, I'm trying to think, maybe 25,000 people. There was one place for meetings, and it was at a club. There were no meetings and never had been meetings in churches, and things were a lot different, and there were not a lot of sober people, and they did not observe a lot of the traditions of this program. And I did have a real difficult time, and I was pretty vocal about it. And I was told in no uncertain terms that if I didn't like the way they did it, I didn't have to go back to those meetings anymore. And I helped start with three other people a meeting of As Bell Sees It in Vicksburg, and that worked real well for us for a period of time. I've said this often, and I didn't have the luxury, and I'm grateful to my higher power now that I didn't, but I didn't have the luxury of running. Not very many people liked me. Up front, no holds barred, not many people liked me because I told the truth about this program, and I dared to say what I liked and didn't like about some things that were going on there. I had to look at myself, and I had to look at my program, and I didn't have the luxury of running down to meetings and just spilling my guts and going home and everything was okay. And I think that I had a lot of personal growth. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was very, very angry. I did not believe in God. I would not say the word God for the first year of my sobriety. And I had to learn to rely on the God of my understanding when I lived elsewhere, or I would not have been able to have maintained my sobriety. We faced a lot of difficult times in Mississippi, and my husband is sober in this program, and there were many deaths in his family, there were deaths in my family, and life happened. Life that we all experienced happened, and we didn't have to pick up a drink because of that. I had one bright thing to look forward to. I lived each day practicing the principles of this program. I was grateful for each day. I did my part each day. I was a sober, responsible woman each day. But I was able to make positive plans for the future, and I was taught that I could do that. I couldn't do that when I was newly sober because I was living erratically and one moment at a time sometimes, and I couldn't see beyond my own belly button and the next day and the next minute sometimes. But when I was living in Mississippi, I could make positive plans for the future, and I knew that my husband was going to retire and that we were going to move back to Maryland. And whether this is the best AA in the whole country, I have absolutely no idea. But I can tell you that it's the very best AA in the country for this drunk, because this is where I got sober. And this is where I learned about the steps, and I learned about the God of my understanding, and I learned about the traditions. And I believe that without my firm foundation in this program, I would have been lost, that I would have gone off somewhere and probably would have drunk again. I know that I have another drunk in me, and I have known from the moment I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people say, oh, so you don't know, you don't know. I say, I know, it's here. I do not believe that I have another sobering up. I was so close to killing myself at that point, and I wanted to live because of my son, only because of my son. I still had a spark of love for my son, even though I hated myself. That I believe that if I go out, and I have a progressive fatal illness, that if I go out and drink again, I will not get sober, that I will die. And that's not a bad thing. You know, a little fear, a little healthy respect for the disease that I have, I believe is a good thing. What I'm like today, I told somebody earlier, what you see is what you get. And where's Lola? My hair is, well, I haven't seen Lola for years. Here she is. My hair is getting gray. I have mellowed in many areas, except when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I try not to take myself too seriously. When I was newly sober, I was so serious. I couldn't understand how you people could laugh about these things that were so painful to me. You know, I didn't come in here feeling good, and I didn't come in here feeling happy, and I didn't come in here with a lot of laughter and being a clown. When I came in here, I was hurting, and I wanted everybody in my world to hurt, and you all were laughing and having a good time, and I couldn't understand that. After I'd been sober a while, then I couldn't understand how anybody could not laugh, and I didn't want to be around the sad asses anymore, and I wanted everybody to laugh. And I finally leveled out a little bit and realized we're all human, but I try not to take myself too seriously today. And I can do that. I can get into so-and-so said, and this is the way it should be, I keep saying my husband Jim over there is my husband, but he has a sponsor down in Memphis, Tennessee, and they weren't doing things my way in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and we went to a convention up in Memphis, and I was moaning and groaning to Louise, and I was saying, well, you know, they don't do this, and they don't do that, and they don't do this, and she'd look at me and she said, honey, they are just not doing things your way. And I realized that it was a lot of those things. I wanted them to be doing it the way they do it in Maryland, not the way they do it in Mississippi. And that's exactly what I wanted. It was my way. So I'm still trying, people, but I'm trying very hard to see things from someone else's point of view, that I don't have to have things my way. I'm a grandmother now. The child that I left was 13 when I got sober. He just celebrated his 33rd birthday. He's the father of two. And I also have four other grandchildren. I've got to stop and count. I have a total of four children now, three stepchildren that are like my children and my own son. I am a good grandmother. I'm a good mother-in-law. And I'm a good mother. And I know that because my kids tell me that. And I'm a good all of those things because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I try to treat my children the way I would want to be treated. And I don't have to run their lives. And I don't try. And sometimes I think, you know, Maybe it would be a little better if I did get in there and try to help some. That maybe they think they're not loved because I don't help them a lot. And then I think, no, I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing in the lives of these young people. They have to live their own lives. They have to make their own mistakes. I am a tremendous employee. I was a good employee and I was a good nurse, even when I was drinking, and I know that. But as a sober person, and I work for that woman today, and I'm teaching, and I work for that woman today, and she can say, Sue, this is what I want you to do, period. And she doesn't have to give me directions, and she knows that she's going to get exactly what she asked for, and that she's not going to have to do it herself nor tell me how to do it, and I am worth every penny that she pays me, and that's not ego, that is the truth. I believe that we become weller than well, and she's got a lot of sick people working for her, and it's not me. But I do. I go the extra mile because I know I'm sober and I'm responsible, and that's what I'm supposed to do. I didn't always go that extra mile as a drunk, but it's my responsibility to do that. I'm a good neighbor. I'm a good wife, and I believe that. Right. I'm supposed to have a cheering section over there. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for all those things. Most important today is that I have a spiritual life. And I believe for a very sick woman who came into this program that couldn't say the word God, the fact that I can even say, it's taken me a long time, but the fact that I can even say the most important part of my existence and the reason why I am here is because of the God of my understanding. And that the thing that keeps me on an even keel, and I really am most of the time today, it hasn't always been that way, it's because of the God of my understanding in my spiritual life. I try to give back in my way what's been given to me in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not always the way that other people would have me do it, but it certainly is my way, and that's all I have. Randy, that very first sponsor, my first sponsor was a male. I was told not to get one. I was supposed to get a woman, so I got a man, and he took me to his home and introduced me to his wife and made sure that I understood that there would be no hanky-panky and that as soon as possible I was to get a female sponsor. And I was stunned by this because even though I've always worn thick glasses and have always been short and maybe sometimes cute but never pretty, I never had any problems manipulating men, and I really believed that I could manipulate him and I could do things my own way. Well, I had a lot to learn. He was a sober man that knew the big book back and forth, and he was the sober man and I was the drunk, and he was in control, period. He did not allow the drunk to control what was going on, and I use that today a lot with people that I sponsor or if someone calls me. I'm the sober woman and I'm in control. And what I'm in control with is I have the backing of Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've learned in these rooms and what I learned from my sponsors and what I learned from other people that I hang out with, and they're all winners. So I know where I'm coming from and where I'm going, and I'm not going to be manipulated by a new drunk. That's enough about that. It happened recently where somebody tried. That's why that comes to mind. I don't know where I fit in God's picture. I really don't. And I'm going to stop soon. I'm going to try to get this out. I spoke last weekend down in Virginia. And I tried to tell this story, and I cried, and I said, I'm going to finish this. Because sometimes, you know, we look out, and we see each other, and we're in these rooms all the time, and I know that I'm passing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe somebody will hear. And if nobody gets anything out of this, man, we're going to have a great weekend here, and there are lots of other speakers, and I've been doing this for a long time. But God has plans for us that we're not even aware of lots of times. And this made me stop and be so grateful for what I've been given. I told you that I'm teaching now. And one of the things, and I teach some nursing things and some general things, and one of the things that I teach is CPR. And Jim knows about this. But I got a call from a nurse who moved away from my area. And she left a message to be given to me that she'd been in the parking lot that day and she heard a mother screaming, and she was able to go to her assistance. Now, she had been taught adult CPR along the line, but had never been taught infant, and I insisted that she learn the infant CPR. I said, you may never know when you'll need it. You may be in a grocery store sometime, and somebody will ask you for help. And when she called back, she said, tell Sue I was in a grocery store. And I went out to the parking lot, and a mother was calling for help. And I gave the baby CPR, and I saved the baby's life. And something, you know, it just, I was totally overwhelmed that this drunken woman, this person that had no choice, that had to drink, that was suicidal, that thought her life was over at age 36, was able to teach somebody that she hadn't even met how to do something, and that person was able to save the life of a child that I'll never meet. I mean, is God's plan complicated or what? I'll never understand all this. But I know that I have moments of real gratitude, and it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can say that. We touch, each one of us touches lives in ways that we don't even know about. And without sobriety, I can't do that. And man, I want to keep on doing that. How about let's have a wonderful weekend, y'all? And that's all I'm going to say. Did I go long enough, Kenny? This is great. I'm going to enjoy and love this weekend. And thanks for listening. You've been great.